Beyond the Dark on Radio City 96.7 and City Talk 105.9.
Ladies and gentlemen, we love to find interesting people. I think we've hit the jackpot this time. We're going to speak to a man who has sold 13 million copies of a book called Life After Life, Dr. Raymond Moody. Hello, Raymond.
Hello, Peter, and I'm so grateful to you for enabling me to talk about this subject.
My pleasure. I've only got one question to ask you, which will lead us into everything. Why have 13 million people bought this book?
Well, I got to hand the credit to two people, Plato and Dr. George Ritchie, who was a professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia in the 60s. And I was just born in one of these. My dad was not religious. He was a medic during World War II and a surgeon and a professional military officer. And as I gather, because, you know, that generation didn't really talk, but he must have been through some horrific things. And so how this came out in my life was that we didn't go to church. So I grew up an avid amateur astronomer, and very early in my life just decided, well, you know, when you die, your body rots and your consciousness goes to zero. And so I went to the University of Virginia in 1962 with the idea of studying astronomy, but immediately got whisked away into philosophy, which I actually ended up majoring in. And in reading Plato's Republic, I heard this story of, I read this story of Ur, who was a warrior who was bleed dead on the battlefield, but he spontaneously revived at his funeral, and he told his comrades of leaving his body and going through a passageway into another world in which he saw his life in review and so on. And I knew about these near-death experiences from the context of the interest that the ancient Greek philosophers had in them. And then in 1965, I met Dr. Ritchie, who had such an experience, and himself. And subsequent to that time, I've interviewed literally thousands of people from all over the world who have these phenomenal experiences when they almost die, that assure them that there is life after death. And that's the success of that book.
Is it, Raymond, I've got to ask, when you say that, you sound like an incredibly intelligent man that knows exactly what you're talking about. Did you have to question it over and over again, even though you spoke to so many people?
Yes, absolutely, I did, Peter. And I will say this, however, that the people are, you know, just completely pure, I'll use that term. I mean, especially since so many of these patients I was interviewing in a hospital shortly after they had a life-threatening crisis and so on, and people are not prone to make up stuff in that sort of situation. I mean, so that first part of it was never an issue to me. It was always obvious that these people were sincere and that they were reporting what they felt actually happened to them. The part that kept me guessing for many, many several decades was, you know, the notion of an afterlife is so counterintuitive to me because I didn't have any exposure to it when I was a kid. It mm-hmm. just seemed so off base or out of nowhere. And it's only been in the last about 3 years that I reached the point where if I sort of survey all that I have learned in the last 40-something years doing this, and I would try to say any other statement, make any other statement than, my God, there's life after death, I felt myself consciously trying to escape or rationalize, rather than just to face straight on what seems to be. So here I am in 2012, in the very odd position for me to actually having to acknowledge that, yes, it does seem to me that there is life after death, which is not anything I ever would have thought in growing up.
Looking at your picture, I'm an older man. I think we're maybe the same sort of age. Does that also affect you? Do you think that gives you a bit of comfort knowing this now, or does that give you a fear factor?
Well, you know, I can't really say either. To me, it's just what is. I mean, you know, what I want to know is what is. And that's a very difficult thing to find out. And I still think, you know, frankly, I think when you hear these people on TV or whatever, and radio and sing, sometimes there are people who say, oh, I have scientific evidence of life after death and so on. That, to me, is a cue that the person really doesn't know what they're talking about. And because, you know, in reality, and, you know, I think this is interesting. I was... My period of special interest in philosophy was the ancient Greeks, but the philosophical tradition I was trained in for my PhD was the analytical empiricism, Hume and Locke, and J.L. Austin being my favorite 20th century philosopher, and so on. And so, you know, that kind of mind frame is actually the kind of mind frame you need to engage with this question, because the question of life after death is almost by definition not yet a scientific one, because to be a scientific question, a question at least has to be, that there has to be at least some methodology that you could conceive and succinctly describe that would enable you to answer the question. But that's in the sense of, in this big question of life after death, there is not an intelligible hypothesis there that can be tested by the scientific method. And since I was an undergraduate, I've always thought that David Hume had it right. And he said in his essay on immortality, "By the mere light of reason, it seems difficult to prove the immortality of the soul." And then he went on to say, "Some new species of logic is requisite for that purpose, and some new faculties of the mind, that they may enable us to comprehend that logic." And Hume really, he got it exactly right, and that is that the question is so vast and curious in an odd way that we just don't have the logical equipment to make a... definitive statement on it either way, I think.
I'm talking to Dr. Raymond Moody, who's got a book out called Life After Life, one of many books, by the way, that this man has written, and this one's particularly has sold 13 million copies. Is there one person you spoke to that left a real sort of thought process with you after speaking to him that you thought, I can't get this person out of my mind?
You know, a very good example of that would be Dr. George Ritchie, Peter. He was, as I mentioned, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia in the 60s. And he was the first living person from whom I heard such an experience. And George, to this day, I can honestly tell you, and I'm 67 now, George is the finest human being I ever knew in my life. Now, that said, he had a remarkable experience during World War II when he was a recruit in the Army and was pronounced dead of double lobar pneumonia. Now that said, let me flash forward a bit to, Peter, I think I can honestly tell you the most amazing near-death experience I have ever heard. I've heard just in the past few months, and this story is so incredible that I can't help but conjecture that this is going to be a major international story when this surfaces. And let me explain. Dr. Eben, that's E-B-E-N, Alexander III, was for 15 years a professor of neurosurgery at Harvard. And his list of publications in the neuroscience journals and medical journals, it just goes on and on and on infinitely. Well, Eben is now in his early 50s and vibrantly alive. However, and I should also explain that because of his profession, you know, many people in that profession of neurosciences have this kind of blind faith that the neurophysiological knowledge is going to solve the riddle of consciousness for us. And so what they conjecture is that there's nothing to consciousness except the biochemical and electrical reactions in the brain. So that was his stance. Now, in November of 2008, Eben developed E. coli meningitis, and I want, for fear of inducing a hyperventilation spell here, I'll spare you the gory details, mm-hmm. but let me just say, this is an horrific illness, and it's exceedingly rare in adults, and when it does occur, it's usually infants that get this, but when it does occur in adults, it's virtually unsurvivable, and in those few cases that it survived, the people are impaired afterward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in November of 2008, Eben developed this illness. And because of his colleagues were, of course, very concerned about him, and he was carefully monitored throughout the 1 week he spent in coma. And the distribution of the lesions and the medical records and the scans and so on show conclusively that by the current neurophysiological understanding of consciousness, he couldn't have been conscious. So the doctors told his wife and kids that he would, you know, probably die, but, you know, that they thought he would die, but that if he did pull through, he would be impaired. So, defying expectations, he came out of this, and when he did, he had this amazing story of a voyage into another world. And throughout this, he kept seeing this young woman that he who seemed to be at a distance, and she would sort of stand back and watch him, and was obviously concerned about him, but never, you know, came forward and made a contact. Now, after he recovered from this illness, he got to thinking and reflecting about his life, as people usually do in this sort of situation, and he began to muse about his adoption. He had been adopted at the age of 4 months, and he had been born in an institution for unwed mothers in North Carolina, and he was adopted at age 4 months by his neurosurgeon father in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Now, what he had been told about his birth parents was that they had been childhood sweethearts, but that after his birth, that they went their separate ways. But in this period of reflection, after his ordeal, he contacted a woman at the institute where he had been born, and he found out that actually his birth parents had married after his birth and had gone on to have several other children. Well, he made a contact with them, and when he did, they were in deep mourning about the loss of their daughter, and when he saw the picture of the daughter, guess who it was? This woman he had seen in the vision. And what I'm getting at here, Peter, is something like this is just very impossible to dismiss and very difficult even to think of some plausible way to explain it away.
The only thing I can say to you, Raymond, is I've never been that quiet in my life. That's a hell of a story.
Isn't that amazing?
That's a hell of a story.
That's exactly what I think, Peter. I'm just blown away. I met Eben in September, and I've been kind of reeling with this ever since.
Raymond, what do you want people to take from this book, Life After Life?
Well, you know, I think that I have thought since I was 18 years old that whether it's resolvable or not, that the question of life after death is the most important question of existence. And I think life after life can give us a some kind of hope. You know, it's not a proof of life after death, but it really does make you wonder, because these experiences are just very difficult, I think, to explain away in ordinary terms.
You're a fascinating man. How can they buy the book?
Well, you know, it's been available in Britain, I think, since 1975.
Oh, wow.
And it's also on... Does Amazon...
Yes, we have Amazon.
Amazon. And, yes, and it's in many bookstores. And my new book about my memoirs, too, is Paranormal, which is about the process that I went through to reason out all this stuff. And so both of those are pretty much current now, I think.
That's an interesting idea. So you write a book called Life After Life, and then another book on why you wrote the book, Life After Life.
Yeah, and you know,
great idea.
It wouldn't occur to me, because, you know, just to tell you the truth, I was a forensic psychiatrist working in a... maximum security unit with the with the kind of people that you read about in the tabloids and all, you know, these gory, horrific killings. And so after that experience, I've never thought that my life was very interesting, frankly. But I wouldn't, by comparison with what I'd seen in that context. But several years ago, my publisher asked me if I would... do my memoirs, and I thought, well, sure. And it was a very interesting process, because I got to reflect on myself. I tend to be not exactly a workaholic, but I just love to work all the time. And I think the process of going through writing those memoirs woke me up to the fact that I hadn't spent much time thinking about myself for many years. And so in that sense, I guess you and I are both World War II babies, essentially. And you know, that generation really had a sense of effort.
Yeah.
That now, I think, less so in Britain than in the U.S., but it's definitely making inroads over there, too. It's the immediate gratification mentality, you know, and that people want it now, and they want it without effort. They want it without going through the process that makes it worthwhile. And so... you know, I think that having been in that mind frame where I just work all the time, I'd kind of lost track of myself in a way. And so writing the memoirs was an eye-opening experience.
Raymond, just getting back to Life After Life before you go, did they make a film of it?
Yes, there have been many films that were kind of came out around that time. And there was one... documentary that was made, that's right, and several kind of popular movies.
Yeah. Interesting.
On the same theme.
Dr. Raymond Moody, you're a fascinating man. The book is called Life After Life. It's sold over 13 million copies. Your memoirs is called what?
Paranormal.
And we can find them all on Amazon.
Oh, yes.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you very much. And this has been delightful, Peter. I always love to be in contact with Great Britain, even if it's only over the phone, because my favorite city is London.
Raymond, you should come to Liverpool sometime. It's wonderful, too. All right?
I love it.
Thank you for speaking to me.
Thank you, Peter, and thanks to Jonathan, too.
Liverpool's biggest after-hours talk show, Late Night City, with Pete Price, on Radio City 96.7 and City Talk 105.9.